That is the way things are.
Comstock, and this is the next installment of the late Maureen Heaton's 1990 unpublished manuscript entitled The Impossible Dream, exposing the new feudalism that's coming. Chapter 22, Get First Understanding. It opens with a quote from John Adams from the Boston Gazette in 1763. Quote, take no man's word against evidence, nor implicitly adopt the sentiments of others who may be deceived themselves, or may be interested in deceiving us, unquote. The material presented in this tome is only a fraction of the information needed to begin to meet the Herculean challenges confronting any who would immobilize the forces behind the destruction of civilization as the world has known it. What is offered here is intended to provide a starting point for a more productive opposition to the revolution. While we can offer our evaluation of the situation and present some of the steps we believe must be taken, only you, fellow American, can be the arbiter and the catalyst for any counteroffensive. In any case, the first step toward any such objective must be recognition of the true nature of the struggle, which has convulsed the world at an accelerating pace this past 100 years. A major error promoted by the protagonists of the revolution is the nature of the battle. It is not against communism, nor socialism, nor any of the several concepts which have engrossed the public in the past. This battle is against a Machiavellian scheme to usurp dominion, to alter the very essence of the lives of all mankind. It is, in fact, a battle for the minds of men. Omitting that fact from any strategy created to meet the challenge dooms any hope of realization of success against the forces now engaged in sweeping every vestige of self-determination off the face of the earth. The first order of business must be recognition of the almost unrestrained penetration of the established concept. While the problems loom large on a worldwide front, recognition of the source of those penetrations will inevitably trace back to manipulation, which has disrupted neighborhoods everywhere. So the next step is for each individual to examine the evidences of that penetration in his own community, become familiar with the programs being implemented, and then begin to spread his understanding. So long as there is acceptance of any premise that the road ahead leads to any form of political organization other than serfdom, there is minimal possibility of rousing sufficient resistance to the scheme for transferring dominion to this self-appointed cabal now rushing toward their goal. The world, as painted by George Orwell in his definitive book, 1984, is the world as it will be. The form of that world is already taking shape, as the examples cited here truly show. We ignore, at our peril, the warning Orwell gave. Control must be wrested from the existing power structure, and the eradication of that control must begin in the mind of every human being who treasures individual liberty. Recognition that these megalomaniacs do have a weapon more powerful than any conventional arsenals provide is of the essence. Defusing that weapon has to begin with each individual. Once personal recognition of the altered concept which permits use of that weapon is achieved, the next step must be to spread that recognition to every person in one's orbit who shares the basic human urge for self-determination. In the United States, the goal must be to return to the political system provided in the Constitution. That will not be easy, but it can be done if there is enough resistance to hold the aggressors at the present line of battle while it is being accomplished. Until that objective can be achieved, it is vital that every American now in office who can be reached is made aware of his responsibility to preserve and defend the elements of that political system. A basic requirement is rethinking, individually, one's political responsibility. In the United States, every citizen, native or voluntary, is a political being simply by virtue of that citizenship. When politics are left to politicians, the silver cord tying the citizen to his birthright is severed. When the best possible candidates for representation reject public service for whatever reason, the void can be, and usually is, filled with people with a vested interest not necessarily supportive of the government provided in the Constitution, nor of the interests of his fellow citizens. I'm going to pause right there and just say again my own disclaimer. Maureen Heaton in 1990 was pro-Constitution. Gordon Comstock, 2008, is not. I have been persuaded through the work of such men as James Montgomery and The Informer, whoever his real name is, and other researchers, that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were a fraud perpetrated on the American public way back when. Go to atgpress.com, againstthegrainpress.com, if you doubt that, and read what's there, folks. Okay, back to the book. That there is still room for moving incumbents was proven in the matter of increasing the salaries of Congress. Even those Americans who do not yet know the long-range goal of the revolutionaries can be enlisted to oppose such a cynical move. The idiocy of claiming, after having spent billions of dollars to win seats on the Washington merry-go-round, that the victors could not afford to sit there, roused a hornet's nest which could not be denied. Many of those are the same quote-unquote legislators who voted to confiscate seniors' cost-of-living allowances to pay for the increased costs of their medical needs. Is there no shame among the perpetrators of this fraud? It would not be too hard to find out if the victims of the Medicare scam imitated the strategy used to stop the pay raise. But once more, the determination to achieve establishment objectives permitted the raise anyway. It was brought to the floor again and passed sans hearings, sans objection, sans any visible concern that the public will make them accountable when they come up for election again. This situation goes to the heart of the political system of this country. Under the Constitution, Congress is elected to represent the national interests of the people in their districts. By becoming residents of the Washington area, those people we elect move their interest from the local district to the domain of the revolutionaries. There you go, Maureen. Yep, you're right. There you go. They become visitors in their own districts, with little time or opportunity to keep abreast of the wishes of the people who elected them. They become instead minions of the clique now directing their activity. To some degree, this is also true of those sent to state capitals. In far too many cases, the people who seek office are financed by outside interests because they do not receive campaigns from nor enjoy the confidence of those who will be voting. This is how the situation constantly decried develops, where the choice of candidates is, quote, the lesser of two evils, unquote. Amen, Maureen. By the way, folks, tell your Christian friends who vote for the lesser of two evils, just remind them, please, that voting for the lesser of two evils is still a vote for evil. Man, think, people. Back to the book. Pressures from these outside sources have a telling effect on those elected at the local level, unless those who offer for office do so with the support of those they represent, the result is predictable. At some point in time, there must begin a rollback of the time elected officials spend away from the grassroots. Until that time comes, how much better would it be to require legislators to maintain their families among their own people, even if it means separation from them for periods of time? The money requested to, quote, maintain homes, unquote, in Washington could better be applied to providing travel back to their districts. This would give members of Congress as much time with their families as many traveling salesmen, for instance, have. Encourage contact with their constituents and discourage continuing the long sessions of Congress, which presently provide the opportunity for extending the revolution through manipulation of the decision-making process by the revolutionaries, who presently have more access to elected officials than those they are claiming to represent. This concept also applies to those elected to state office. The next step is to encourage those local officials who are receptive to the pleas of those who elected them to cut off support from the revolutionary agents of change who presently are receiving public monies to continue their revolutionary activity. This means the dues paid to any and every 1313 body, as well as removing the opportunity given to 1313 to brainwash local officials. What is this 1313 business stuff, Maureen? I'm not sure. To brainwash local officials who now attend their schools for subversion called, quote-unquote, meetings to discuss, quote-unquote, local problems. How much better their time would be spent discussing local problems with those actually burdened by the problems. While this is being done, citizens should be making plans to obtain the consent of the best men and women in their communities to run for office in the next election. It cannot be stressed strongly enough that the greatest public service American citizens can perform is to represent their fellow citizens. Serving in appointed positions for whatever purpose does not compare with being the official voice of the community. When this is done, 2 years is all it will take to begin destruction of the revolutionary replacements for our federal structure and to immobilize the machinery of foreign policy while it is being reconstructed to fortify the interests of the United States. Simplistic? Yes. But complex problems do not necessarily require complex solutions. Unless such simple steps as these are taken, there is no way the revolutionary assault can be met with any realistic hope of reversing its progress. Chapter 23, I'd Rather Be Right. Americans are reeling from the barrage of words which daily assault them on every front. An ever-mounting war against tradition is taking its toll as chaos follows confusion in the wake of erroneous information and altered concepts which assume the mantle of truth by steady repetition. In the confusion, even those who do know better find themselves accepting strange, quote-unquote, democratic forms of government function. Democracy is served by opinion polls, citizens' committees and commissions, protest and support activities, and a host of other techniques. All are destructive of representation. Opinion polls are the current promotion. Just as hula hoops once swept the country, polls make about as much sense as tools for determining the direction a nation shall take as the hoops would have. What shall be done about nuclear power? Ask the man in the street. He has received his vast knowledge of the subject from some half-vast radical who has been lionized into a national figure by the kept news media. So, of course, he is an expert. Substitute for nuclear power any complicated problem of today, and the answer is the same. Ask the man in the street. Legislative polls are a spin-off, and an important one, of the opinion-gathering strategy. It is a rare congressperson or senator who doesn't demonstrate his deep-seated desire to, quote-unquote, represent his constituency by a more or less regular questionnaire. No matter that the questions are mass-produced, many equivocal, most designed to elicit a predetermined response, none address the truly vital issues involved in our daily lives. No matter that facts about the subject under scrutiny are not even included, thousands of dedicated Americans dutifully ponder the weighty matters for which their reaction is solicited and, with a righteous conviction that they are performing a civic responsibility, they fill the little boxes with appropriate X's and fire their opinion off to the source of the quiz. Little they know of the rapacious computers, scientifically programmed to accept these freely given responses, to use for other than the stated purposes. As a case in point of the willingness of the American people to accept the legitimacy of quote-unquote polls, here is this. A recent public opinion poll purported to show that fully 45% of those polled considered themselves to be, quote, right of center, unquote, politically. Of this 45%, 16% claimed to be, quote, substantially right, unquote, and 8% allowed that they were, quote, far right, unquote. The poll did not tell them where, quote, unquote, center was, and it did not try to determine whether or not that was even known. But of course, everyone knows what, quote, unquote, right is, right? Well, no. Everyone does not, because many have accepted the propagandized concept of quote-unquote right and the equated quote-unquote conservative. It would be more to the point to begin such a poll by asking Americans where quote-unquote center was, Having done that, the result of the poll, which concluded that this country is experiencing a, quote, shift to the right, unquote, would have some validity, and the efforts of the daily brainwash could be neutralized to some extent, as the politicos shifted into high gear for the quadrennial personality contest to select Mr. America. Was that, quote, shift to the right, unquote, from the left toward the center, or from the center toward the right? The answer to this is vital to the 47% mentioned in the poll, to the 16%, and the 8%. But equally, to the other 53%, and the great globe itself. Because, my friends and foes, if the center is the limited government supplied by the Constitution of these United States, and that shift is from the left toward the center, then it is right. But if it is from the center to the right, that's wrong. Because, quote, far left, unquote, is totalitarian dictatorship, toward which the self-proclaimed enemies of our legitimate government have been steering this ship of state for these many years. And the, quote, far right, unquote, is anarchy. Moving from the forced march into a proposed, totally managed and controlled society, toward the sanity of balanced powers, carefully maintained, is a rational direction to take. Moving away from that legitimate center is less than sane. It is more like treason. Wouldn't you rather be right on center? Chapter 24, All the World a Stage. Those who read only general circulation outlets cannot know the specifics of the worldwide revolution. The, quote, mass media, unquote, makes no attempt to provide either in-depth or sequential reports on events which are transforming the United States of America from a constitutional republic into an administrative dictatorship, let alone those events affecting other countries. One would never know from news reports that those events are preparing the amalgamation of a world conglomerate of equalized states, once sovereign nations, melded into a single manageable unit. This is revolution. On a scale never even envisaged before now. Had it not been for the few remaining independent local papers, even fewer specialty weekly or monthly outlets, created to fill the gap left by the demise of non-conforming major news sources, a dwindling number of radio and TV programs dedicated to hard news, and a smattering of pamphleteers carrying on in the tradition of Thomas Paine, the revolution would have been over long since, and the world would never have known what happened. As it is, a handful of hardy souls, undaunted by the odds, have kept the spotlight turned on characters and activity behind the charade holding center stage, and the drama is not yet over. Adult Americans, whose only background in politico-socio-economic matters, have been supplied by the public schools and the mass media during the past 50 years, they have a distinct disadvantage in seeking answers, for they have been denied vital information and given distorted versions of much of history. To an uninformed public, baffled by events which make no sense, a seeming continuity exists, but a shadow of unreality hangs over the socio-political scene. That shadow is evidenced in problems never solved, in solutions which create more problems, in a perceived deterioration of all the proven values, methods, and institutions. Representative government appears to be functioning, but behind the scenes, a, quote, scientific bureaucracy, unquote, has been created. Quote, a disciplined organization of officials appointed by representative bodies of diminishing importance and coming at last to be the working control of the state, unquote. Examples of the, quote, working control, unquote, abound in the reports of those limited circulation papers just mentioned. The links between local moves and state action, between both or either of these and the federal initiatives, are exposed and explained there, but not in the mass media. Knowledge of this vital information about the collaboration between government departments is vital in any attempt to diffuse this revolution. Occasionally, the, quote, disciplined organization of officials, unquote, moves in ways that defy detection, even by the most watchful monitors. It was so when the control system, designed to manage and institutionalize the programs of the scientific bureaucracy, was written into the script. Initiated in the late 60s by agents of the Rockefeller-created, quote-unquote, 1313 conglomerate, of which more later, a program to suborn the sovereign states of Wisconsin, Vermont, New York, Michigan, and California into acting as stand-ins for the other 45 states, while strategies, tactics, and techniques were perfected to penetrate the rest, was incubated at George Washington University under a blanket of secrecy. This was the infamous, quote, 555 Project, unquote, subtitled, quote, Implementing, Planning, Programming, and Budgeting in 5 States, 5 Cities, and 5 Counties, unquote. The project was not done under legislative approval. Legislators were not told, in California at least, that their state, by executive fiat, was acting as a, quote, pilot project, unquote, in an unprecedented, untried experiment. They were manipulated into approving a, quote, management system, unquote, by passing seemingly innocuous bills, purportedly mandating a new method of, quote, budgeting and accounting, unquote, which were, in fact, mandating the Planning, Programming, and Budgeting System, PPBS. The Planning, Programming, and Budgeting System, PPBS, is the revolutionary strategy to assure management and control of the worldwide hegemony. What is clear now, but wasn't then, is that this, quote-unquote, project was staged like one of Hollywood's spectaculars. The legislators were handed the script and read their parts as directed. if any of them recognized that their new role as subordinates to the, quote, disciplined organization of officials, unquote, none rose to protest, and in California, only one dissenting legislative voice was ever heard beyond the confines of the state capitol. And the mass media made no waves about this perversion of their vaunted, quote, democratic process, unquote. At the local level in California, trained change agents were already jumping the gun, preparing local districts for the new age when they would be the battle line troops handling the transition into systematic control. The script called for, quote, data processing, unquote, to provide, quote, fiscal accountability, unquote, for the state, and an, quote, advisory commission, unquote, to formulate a, quote, budgeting and accounting system, unquote, for the schools. The legislators in California, for example, with only one dissent, obediently passed their responsibility to protect the integrity of the state into the waiting hands of the, quote, scientific bureaucracy, unquote. In the bill which required the state to install, quote, data processing, unquote, there was also a mandate for the Planning, Programming, and Budgeting System, PPB system. In like manner, the bill creating the Advisory Commission for Education also carried that mandate. These two bills emanated from the executive office then occupied by Ronald Wilson Reagan with a mandatory, quote-unquote, due pass. And pass they did in a record 3 weeks' time. In the bill for the state government in California, the legislator delegated all authority to develop the system to the eager stand-ins waiting in the wings. In the school bill, they extended the, quote, scientific bureaucracy, unquote, beyond the government and into unidentified private hands, by giving the commission authority to hire unspecified, quote-unquote, consultants to do the work. Had they played the part for which they were hired, the legislators would have conducted the hearings the commission held in their stead, and this play would never have been staged. For then, the legislators would have known what was planned and surely wouldn't have approved it. As it was, they delegated their lawful roles to appointed substitutes and illegally gave them authority to hire an external agency which just happened to have a vested interest in the system. Marilyn Ferguson, in her book Aquarian Conspiracy, identified the chairman of the California Assembly Education Committee, John Vasconcelos, parentheses, who played a leading role in implementing the Planning, Programming, and Budgeting program for the schools, and Marilyn Ferguson identifies him as a New Age collaborator. To bring an end to this tragic farce, the curtains must be opened wide, the proscenium bared, and the entire strategy exposed for what it is, a carefully stage-managed production. To accomplish this, a number of things must be done, and with all possible speed. first and most important, is for all resistors to be sure that they know and understand the strategies being used by the manipulators of the quote-unquote scientific bureaucracy. This book is intended to be a refresher course for those who already understand strategies and tactics, a primer for those who don't. Hopefully, this will encourage examination of ways and means to make those strategies work for the resistance. Chapter 15, A Conspiracy of Silence. Gradually, with a general awakening of the American people, a corner of the blanket of conspiracy which has hidden the hands responsible for the redirection of world affairs for almost a century is being lifted. The evidence of a seditious conspiracy has been at issue for almost that long as, from time to time, one or another of its manifestations have caused a ripple of alarm. The establishment image of Franklin Roosevelt was so effective it precluded acceptance of the validity of charges made against him throughout his several administrations, including the most serious one, that he planned to involve this country in World War II, and in fact did so. The same was true of Woodrow Wilson and the first quote-unquote World War. Strong evidence that both these wars were arranged to further the design of an integrated quote-unquote world order planned by a group of identifiable conspirators has never been satisfactorily researched, examined, reported, and dealt with. Determined Americans, at great personal risk, have consistently, over the years, decried the manifestation of a clear and present danger to their lawful government and their individual liberties. The press, with a single voice, leads the pack, baying at the heels of those so brash as to attempt to resist the conspirators' plans. Quote-unquote obstructionist and quote-unquote extremist are some of the milder epithets applied to patriots who fight back. As the conspiracy has flourished and borne fruit, it has been ever more difficult for its promoters to deny its existence. Evidence continues to multiply which supports the theory that the, quote, communist threat, unquote, is, in fact, another fabrication of the establishment schemers. Certainly, quote, unquote, communism has served their cause well in many ways. The overthrow of the Russian government in 1917 provided one country after another in which to initiate pilot programs to test theories of control. Quote-unquote communism became an excuse for extending and escalating distribution of America's bounty all over the world. In this country, quote-unquote communism produced scapegoats on whom to place the blame for the treasonous moves necessary to take control here. The incredible situation vis-a-vis the execution for subversion of the Rosenbergs, viewed against the witness of George Racy Jordan to the actions of the government the Rosenbergs quote-unquote betrayed, gives a horrendous perspective of the conspiracy. On the one hand, the Rosenbergs sent military information to the Soviet quote-unquote enemy. On the other, Jordan testified that the government, which found the Rosenbergs guilty, was sending military information and materiel, including that needed to make use of the information sent by the Rosenbergs, to the same, quote-unquote, enemy, on government planes, no less, and at public expense. Equally incredible, and even more hideous, is the record of the Vietnam obscenity in which America's sons, husbands, and fathers were slaughtered and maimed by the hundreds of thousands, while the government, which sent them to that bloodbath, supplied them with faulty materiel, denied them the goal of victory, and sent weapons, tools, food, and technology through the Soviet apparat to the quote-unquote enemy they fought. With the capability for such crimes against a just government and mankind itself, can it be successfully argued that the present incumbent of the United States presidency could not place ambition above the interests of those he is supposed to serve? Is it safe to assume that this or any future incumbent is incapable of such treachery? Or that conspirators would not use such a gut issue as that to further their goal? The only possible protection for Americans now is to reject the conspirators' strategy and repudiate any who aspire to the executive office in either of the major parties. Hear, hear, Maureen, right on. Concentration on taking back the seats in government over which citizens can exercise control is the only route to frustrating the conspirators' plans. By denying support to aspirants to the executive office and presenting a massive response to constitutional representatives, Americans can best demonstrate their determination to support and defend their lawful government. Okay, folks, that was, those were chapters 22 through 25 of the late Maureen Heaton's 1990 manuscript entitled The Impossible Dream. You've been listening to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Gordon Comstock, and thank you for listening. God bless.
If I told you now, if I told you now, if I told you now, how would it end? If I told you now, I'll leave my children here. If I told you now,
this world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. That's true. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world. At home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore.
This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. This world where
This world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world.
That is the way things are.